You are listening to the sixth season of the Just Powers podcast. I'm Dr. Sheena Wilson, principal investigator of Just Powers, and I'm joining you from Amiskwichi, Wisconsin, Beaver Hills House, colonially named Edmonton, where the University of Alberta is situated in Western Canada. I'm joined by Patrick Mann, our guest host for all eight episodes of the Reflector series.
Thanks so much, Sheena, and hello to all of you, our listeners. I'm joining you from Eastern Canada on the lands where Western University is located in London, Ontario, on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabeg, the Haudenosaunee, the Lenapewak, and the Tsleil-Waututh Nations, on lands connected with the London Township and the Sombre Treaties of 1796 and the Dish with One Spoon Covenant Wampum. The title of this podcast is Reflector 5, Play and Transformation, and it involves members of the SEF team Natalie Lovelace, Scott Smallwood, Sorayan Mukherjee, Sheena Wilson, and myself, Patrick Mann. In Reflector 5, we look at our game-related projects to think about how we might take on various new worlds and about how playful immersion can be great for reorienting our thinking. One of the game's scores for energy transition is a dice and cards game devised by Natalie Lovelace and Scott Smallwood, housed in our Flux Kit. With its provocations and chance possibilities, it offers great opportunities for us to stretch. The Lost Garden, another game by Scott Smallwood, is a moody sound and video experience for those who love video games and for everyone else too. And Perfect Storm, another game, is a wonderfully complex game by Sorayan Mukherjee that teaches as it tests the imaginations and intellects of its players. Be sure to check the episode description for links to our interactive resources so you can enjoy a visual and auditory encounter with our games as you listen to this podcast. And I wonder if Sheena, you could just sort of remind us who Scott and Sorayan and Natalie are.
Thanks, Patrick. Well, as you're figuring out, if you've been listening to this whole series on research creation, Natalie Lovelace is the co-lead of Speculative Energy Futures along with me, but also we were involved in lots of other sub-projects. So today we're talking about Scores for Energy Transition, and that is a collaboration between Scott Smallwood and Natalie Lovelace. And Scott Smallwood is a professor of composition and sound studies here at the University of Alberta. He's the director of the Sound Studies Institute, and he's taught us so much on this project about listening, deep listening, audio recording, using sound, imagining future sounds. It's been really great to have him on the team. Natalie Lovelace, who you already know and who's already spoken with us, is a professor of contemporary art and theory in the history of art and design. She is a specialist of research creation, actually, and she's been guiding us in those theories all through the project. She is also the author of How to Make Art at the End of the World, a manifesto for research creation. And then we're joined by Sorayan Mukherjee. He has been working on a game in collaboration with many students, and it's been played and activated at many different intervals throughout the last 7 or 8 years. And that game is called Perfect Storm. And he is a professor here at the University of Alberta. He works in the sociology department, where he specializes in decolonizing social theory, critical globalization studies, and intermedia research. I would say that he is a professor of theory and cultural studies and a very important energy humanities scholar. So yeah, that's who joins us today.
Thanks so much, Sheena. And I'll talk a little bit about what we're going to be hearing about specifically. And I think, as we both know, Speculative Energy Futures involves all kinds of scholars, artists, writers, and we're working in cross-disciplinary ways and often working on more than one project at the same time. So here we're going to be hearing specifically about three projects. Now, the first one that we're going to be hearing about is called Scores for Energy Transition. And it was actually worked on by Scott Smallwood and Natalie Lovelace. And it's a dice and card-based dialogic game that invites players to consider the kinds of energy we rely on every day and how we might rethink our relationship between energy and our basic needs. And of course, this is going to become part of the Flux Kit and is very, very kind of similar or has all kinds of analogies to some of the Fluxus-related work that people like Yoko Ono and George Brecht did in the early days of the Fluxus movement. And so in a sense, this game, this project called Scores for Energy Transition really resonates with some of that history. A second game we're going to be hearing about is entitled The Lost Garden. And Scott Smallwood worked on that independently with some of the people in his lab, sort of on the sidelines, I guess we could say. It's a first-person audio puzzle game that features sonic exploration in an abandoned underground urban environment. And the player is really a stranger here. And so they explore the soundscape of a world cut off from nature, perhaps in a sense, a world cut off from a future we might have imagined. But as they solve puzzles, clues are revealed, and the doors to new areas are opened, and ultimately they're led into the outdoors or into that lost garden. And so there's a sense of wonder and possibility attached to a game that I think gives us lots to think about and listen about. And then the third game is by Saroyan Mukherjee, and it's entitled Perfect Storm, Feminist Energy Transition, and that's its subtitle, and it's a role-playing game. So it's designed by Saroyan to enable players to explore the cultural and class politics of energy transition in Canada. So it's interactive, providing an opportunity to examine gamification as an instrument of spectacular participation. And in that sense, I think Saroyan introduces a lot of fairly complex thinking in a way that's both playful, but also interactive. And I think those of us who are involved in speculative energy futures had a great opportunity when we played the game to sort of realize that we need to sometimes put ourselves in the shoes, in the heads of others as we think through some of the challenging problems of energy transition. In this episode, Sheena, we encounter art as player, perhaps better said, play as art. Some of what we're going to be hearing about mimics the Fluxus or data provocations that I mentioned earlier. And so some of these things are almost like parlor games, games that we might sort of play, as it were, after dinner or in a bar with a drink in our hand. And in a sense, there's a kind of surprising variability about how some of these games work. And sometimes they call up emotion, maybe they call up our sort of enjoyment of games or even our dislike of games. And I'm wondering if you recall anything when you were playing any of these or observing others playing some of these games that resonates with you, Sheena.
Thinking about what's surprising is the way in which playfulness is built into the games that in some ways might not even seem like games. Like I would say Scores for Energy Transition can be played as an actual game. It can also be played as a set of prompts for just discussing and figuring out what you know and also figuring out the limits of what you know. I found that when we were activating Scores for Energy Transition in St. Gallen, Switzerland, where a lot of the team went to work with graduate students there in a course on pathways to climate justice, that I was surprised by how it really revealed what we knew or what we didn't. Like if you rolled nuclear, for example, what do you really know about nuclear? What do you know about the role nuclear plays in your community, your country, all of these kinds of things? And then at the same time, you know, you might roll psychic energy, which is a different kind of playfulness and asking for something different. So I was surprised about what it revealed about what we didn't know. And then Sarayan's game, The Perfect Storm, is much the same, but it's a role-playing game. And there you really run up against the limits of what you know in a very, you know, serious way, but it's also an educational tool so that the game itself is built to teach you some things and to collaborate together. So the games have those two things in common, I guess, that, you know, they're really prompts for collaborative learning and sharing what we know so that we can teach each other, because the solutions to these problems don't exist. Otherwise, some of them exist and some people are making sure that they're not known to the world. We know that after 7 years of research, and we knew that when we started. But you know, a lot of the answers to these major complicated problems are not actually known. And so we have to figure them out together. So the games are a play site to model the kinds of conversation and action and learning that needs to take place in order to take action on climate.
Yeah,
No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, when we were playing these games and when you're hearing about the, you know, the designing of these games and the use of these games in the podcast, you'll recognize that they do reveal a lot. I mean, you talked about them revealing sometimes the limits of what we know. They also reveal sometimes our attitudes to, for example, playing by the rules or not playing by the rules. And some of our collaborators certainly admit to the fact that sometimes the rule-bound of games can be a little bit frustrating. I think I'm a rule follower, except when I'm not. And the other thing that came to mind as I was listening to the podcast is there's a certain amount of trespassing that we're talking about at times, or a certain amount of what we might call civil disobedience, or at least the kinds of things that we know sometimes we need to at least consider if we're going to actually be open to change. So that might be something we would listen for as we're listening to the podcast again, you and I, and hopefully our listeners will have the opportunity to sort of consider games in a broader way, in a broader field of even influence.
And I guess the other thing that we really learned through all of this is that whether we're following the rules of the games that these game makers created or whether we're not, it's really about how the rules of the game need to change. And, you know, that metaphor, I think, stands for everything going on socially right now. So being in Scott's game, for example, where you can't quite figure out what's happening and you can't recognize clearly the signs or find the spaces to get through. I remember sitting and playing that in the Prototypes for Possible Worlds exhibition with my kids, right, who liked it because it looks like a video game. You know, that unknowingness and that frustration also comes through. But just the fact that, you know, we don't know what the next step is and we don't know where to find it and the rules of the game need to change. So I think all of that becomes really obvious through all of these games, each in different ways.
So on that note, yeah, let's get into the podcast on gamification or gaming as a way of thinking and expressing and learning and knowing. And we'll come back and think through some of what our friends have told us today. It's great to be with all of you today. So we're going to begin by hearing from Natalie and Scott regarding the specifics of their project together, as well as a second project that Scott worked on his own. And in both cases, these projects do have resonances with aspects of games in art and cultural contexts beyond the kinds of things we're talking about today. So Natalie, if we could start with you and ask you to talk about Scores for Energy Transition, can you talk about specifically how the game works and why it works that way? And maybe give us a sense of what the experience of playing the game might be like.
Sure. I'd be happy to, Patrick. And I might tag you in, Scott, since we did develop it together really iteratively from the get-go and are still finishing some of it up. But the game is a card and dice game. Comes in a little box. And there are three different kinds of cards, and there are dice, and there's some other elements, a little kind of a little whistle and a little top. But the key components are the dice. They're a takeoff of like D&D gamer dice, but what they have are 10 different energy sources, 5 on each side, and some of them are what you'd expect, you know, wind, solar. Some of them are playful. Psychic, right? So 10 different energy sources, and there's a little guide that talks about the different sources. And these dice are used to guide your way through the cards. And the cards offer three different kinds of prompts through thinking about our energy embeddedness, energy reliance, and also energy literacy. So there's a chance element that comes in. So if you have a card, I should have brought the box so I could read one or two. I don't know, Scott, if you have one nearby. You do? Grab one. Yes. Maybe you could read one out or two, because there's some that are experience cards that invite you to think about the role of an energy source in, say, your home where you are. And some of them are dialogic. Some are like designed, go to the pub. Each person, roll a die, have an argument about which energy source is more equitable and efficient in your particular bioregion. Bonus points. make this argument really, really loud over beer, right? Or this kind of thing. It's more eloquent than that. But the idea is to kind of bring some play and fun and chance into conversations about energy embeddedness and reliance and transition. And it also means that you get to test the limits of your knowledge. So for example, if I don't get to like expound at the pub about the thing I know most about or already think, I might get psychic energy or nuclear energy, a source that I might not know about much about, and then be placed in the position of kind of really trying to test the limits of what I already know and what I might want to know. Anyway, Scott, do you have one there? Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. So I'll read to someone else kinds. Some of them are maybe invitations to do something creative. Kind of work of being an artist comes out of this, and sort of the influence of people like Yoko Ono and things like that. And then other ones are, as Natalie described, kind of opportunities to have dialogue with someone else or to imagine something. So here's an experience which is called gravitational. Make a ramp out of wood or metal. Find resonant objects to roll down the ramp. So that's it. So what does that mean? I mean, it's an invitation to engage with the natural energy form of gravity, right? And then to sort of appreciate it through visual and sonic means, essentially, by creating a kind of entropic situation, I guess. And then here's one that says, this is a dialogue score. So this was intended to be done in dialogue with someone else. Each player roll one die. Describe medical products that depend on this energy source. Repeat until someone is flummoxed. So that's a really difficult one, right? That one might not necessarily be easy to do and might involve some research. Some of these scores do sort of imply that one might want to actually take some time to figure it out and go off and do something. Others of them might invite a more spontaneous reaction.
So with that second one, it reminds me of something Sheena, in fact, often says in public talks. And here I'm going to speak for you, Sheena, but as someone who is co-founder of the Petrocultures Research Institute and organized entirely around climate justice and climate action and energy transition, to have someone like that go to the front of the room and say, well, what do we want to save from the age of oil, right? It's not about all bad. It's not about ban all plastics forever, right? Actually, they're like heart bits and valves and things. They're things that plastic does that we do not, like that I'm incredibly grateful for. So how do we think, like with complexity, about the aspects that of these, you know, different processes and energy sources and outputs that are really valuable and the difference between a heart valve and single-use plastics? So there, that medical technology one reminds me of that exactly, like starting to think about, well, then where are these ways of doing and working that have brought us to the modern moment really useful, critical, and not part of what we want to reject? So how is energy transition a complex, multivalent, locally situated project? And that's something that the game really kind of brings us to using these strategies, I think.
That's really helpful, Natalie. When you're describing the game, I was thinking, you know, our expectation is with a lot of games is that there's probably a beginning and you may be working towards an ending. And it didn't strike me when Scott was describing some of these activities that sort of temporality is so much part of what our experience of the game might be. So maybe you could talk a little bit about those things and then we'll go on and hear from Scott about the Lost Garden.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's something that Scott and I have gone back and forth on and struggled with. Scott comes to our collaboration with a deeper investment in games, gaming, and understanding of game structures. I was like, I'm Yoko Ono, one of my all-time heroes, Fluxus, conceptual art, like all of, you know, the aspects of that kind of instruction score, event score practice that involve recalibrating the experience of everyday life into something that's defamiliarized and or intervened into through the kind of framework of, you know, artistic play and artistic intervention. You know, that whole way of working as an artist is something that, you know, feeds me and I'm familiar with. But to gamify it, I got all wiggy. I was like, winners and losers and da 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 da. And so there are, so we do have some of it built in. There's some places where we've got kind of point structures and, or we've got the first one to X loses or the first one to X wins, which does have a kind of beginning, middle, and end. You know, what I was really struck with in all the conversations we had, and we had conversations with like game experts, was the presumption that without a beginning, middle, and end, without the win, no one would want to play. You know, and this basically betrays something, just if you need to know about me as a game player in life. I did grow up with some gaming people in my family, cards and Scrabble and chess and things, and some were really, really competitive and really organized around the win. So I think I decided pretty early on I would only play for fun. I would only play to be part to play and never be organized around winning. So it really did make the whole thing a really interesting kind of exploration for me.
So Scott, Lost Garden is really quite a different game, and it probably has more familiarity to people who are thinking, who are listening to this and thinking about video games. And on the other hand, obviously there's a really important sound component to the game. So do you want to tell us how that works?
Yeah, sure. The Lost Garden was a project that sort of entered my head many years ago, but back, I think it was 2015, 16, thereabout, when I actually started working on making the game. And we got a little bit of funding, and I was able to get some training in the environment where I was building the game. And part of my motivation, I have to say, was I wanted to learn how to do it, because I was starting to understand that games were a really interesting place to engage people. Part of this is just simply a change in the culture and what people do with their time. It used to be a lot more common, for example, for a person to listen to an entire album of music, and the construction of an album was an invitation for an artist to create a longer form, in the same way that in the old days that might have been writing a symphony, right? And that still exists today. But in the age of recorded media, albums were really important ways of doing that. Most of the statistics I've read over recent years tell a different story about what people are engaging with these days, and those are games. And so in addition to that, there's also just a really, really large amount of super interesting games now, with at least from the point of view of sound. And that's been inspiring just to discover. And so part of the motivation was, I want to learn how to do this. And part of it was also having to do with this project, which was making me think a lot about my work in the context of field recording, in the sounds of the world, and the soundscape of climate change, as we all go through it, and we have a better understanding of what's happening to our world and what and the effect that it's having on both what we see and what we experience, and that's also through sound. So this game was an opportunity to find a way to kind of just engage with a lot of different approaches to composing with that in mind, and to create an environment where people could engage with those sounds in a way that led them through different aspects of a potential story. So, for example, during this whole period, I was making recordings in Wood Buffalo National Park in Northwest Alberta. And I found that it was just such a beautiful, untouched sort of soundscape. Very few sounds of cars, planes, automobiles, et cetera. Just a really beautiful kind of canvas. And so part of my motivation was to bring these to people and to have them imagine what it's like to be inside them, and perhaps to see what might happen if that experience was disturbed. So some of the puzzles in the game are about having folks experience that and have to think about that. So I'll give you, and maybe the easiest way to explain this is to just describe one of the puzzles. You walk into a room and all of the lights go out, so you can't see anything. Suddenly you hear the soundscape of Wood Buffalo National Park in its pristine beauty. And it's a three-dimensional recording, so it's a really lovely place to walk around in. But then all of a sudden there's an interlocutor. the sound of an oil well present nearby. And so the task is to find that, like, where is it? And once you find it, you move towards it and you stamp it out, essentially, is kind of what the mechanic ends up doing in the end when you're playing in that particular environment. And so sometimes it was about that kind of thing. And other times it was about contemplating, for example, the sound of a single cricket and actually just like, where's that cricket? There's nothing else. Like, it's a quiet soundscape. I can hear it so well by itself. What an interesting moment. What an interesting opportunity. So anyway, I'm kind of rambling, but that was the motivation. And that was what we were trying to do with the various puzzles in the game. And that's a really fun challenge for a composer, to compose a puzzle that's interacted with and brings people into a different understanding about sound. But I think in most cases, the mechanics that we created, and they've sort of also found their way into other projects as well, it was super rewarding and just made me realize that something ripe medium for not only just being a musician, but also engaging in some of these real world kinds of issues.
Great. Thanks, Scott. And I'm fascinated by your description. One of the things, or some of the things you talked about, though, around libraries of agency, and of course, you referred to rules and the development of a puzzle. I think some of those things actually do map onto what you worked on, Sorayan. Although I know that from experiencing playing your game, there's definitely a more sort of embodied sort of experience that were offered. So I wonder if you could describe how Perfect Storm works, and then we can get us all together around some of the kinds of things we're talking about today.
Sure. Fundamentally, I guess, Perfect Storm is a role-playing board game. There are different characters, and it's a game that, or it's pretty much designed to be played in a workshop setting, though we've played it in conference settings, we've played it in classroom settings, and so on. The game is about the politics of energy transition, and the fictional world has its point of departure in Canada and in Alberta in particular, but it's a fictional world, Great West Colony, it's called. And the characters are, in many respects, familiar characters that people will recognize as being agents in the politics of energy system change. They're people that are doing things and have points of views, have specific politics, specific ideas about how energy system change should unfold, and so on. And it is, in that respect, also very specifically a feminist game in a number of different ways. One is that there's a character that's called Feminist Energy Futures, but also in terms of the politics of energy system change, one of the key parts of the game involves people having an opportunity to really think about sustainability in a way that sustainability is often not thought of, which is the intergenerational reproduction of households and, of course, the ecosystems in which households are embedded. And so one part of the game invites people to sort of do a kind of deep dive into thinking about what do they already do to ensure that their households can reproduce daily, weekly, monthly level, but also over the long term, and whatever, however you can imagine the long term in that regard. And once people have that kind of conversation, the game takes them into another space where they then interact with other avatars and choose a particular strategy that they want to pursue in the game for advancing their idea of energy system change and what they would like to see, and so on. And we were talking earlier about games and the kind of the logic and formal property of winning and losing in them. This game also has a certain dimension of that, where this is where the board game comes in. So there's the third stage of the game where people try to act out the strategies that they've developed by competing and cooperating on a board game. And it's basically that part of it is like a tic-tac-toe game. There's a grid of 9 squares. You have to occupy 3 squares in a row in order to somehow win. But in order to do that, you have to collaborate and cooperate with other people, sign treaties with them or sign contracts with other people to be able to put your players or your pieces down in those spaces. And so you're also competing with other players for that. So the mechanics of how this game unfolds. And one of the important things, I guess, to say about the game is that, and one of the things that makes it quite different from other dialogic games and certainly other science technology games in that regard, is the fact that the game has in its game world the whole question of power as being and politics as being central to the problem that the world is confronting in that regard. And in that respect, it also is different from these other games in the sense that there's a fundamental formal contradiction that the game is built around in the fact that we are playing this one game, but the players play under two different sets of rules. So in effect, it's like two different games, but also one game. There's, in terms of the characters, there are characters that are one category of characters that are big businesses, the oil industry, clean oil, Wall Street world, CNCP transport, giant farms. These are the names of some of those characters. And then there's a range of civil society organizations and households that have names connected to political perspectives and organizations and movements that exist in the world. So things like the environmental movement is a character that's called Indigenous Energy Action. There's the Great West Labor Congress, Activist Intermedia, the Feminist Energy Futures, and a character called Most of the World, and so on. And there's also Wall Street and the Government of Great West Colony are some of the other characters.
Thanks, Ryan. I'm really fascinated by your game, and I remember playing it and finding it very immersive. And at the same time, also a situation where we needed to, you know, people need to, as you say, cooperate, all that sort of thing. And I was wondering about when you set out to design the game, you know, what was your goal? And was the idea that this was going to be fundamentally educational and in some ways actually give practical ways of thinking about the problems? You know, was that a key sort of objective of what you were doing, or were there other things you were thinking about?
No, thanks. That's a really great question. And there was definitely a research dimension in terms of my interest in doing this as a game. Also, in that respect, as a kind of way of intervening in and participating in the politics of energy system change in that kind of way. And it was a way for me also thinking about, well, as a researcher, what are some of the kinds of tools or resources I can contribute to my community, to social movements, to political organizations, and so on, that are trying to deal with this immensely complicated and hugely urgent situation of, in terms of what we do with our energy system, for them to be able to use this game to both work with their communities, their constituencies, to educate other people. I mean, there is definitely an educational dimension of this game in that regard that's very important. The game itself has its roots in my own teaching of an undergraduate course. I had taught at this cultural studies course in my department for quite some time, where I have used other games in the course of teaching that course, one that was on the cultural politics of pipelines and so on. And so when we started this research project, And the pipeline kind of debate in Canada had sort of quietened down for a bit. So I thought, well, this is the time to develop a game on energy system change. And it would be a good way to begin to try and figure this out in a classroom context. So very much the question of this being an educational game is really a key part of it. So those are my main motivations for why I chose a game to kind of do this kind of work with.
Great. Thank you. Sheena, I wanted to bring you into the conversation as we begin more of a roundtable. And I just made a few notes about what we've been hearing about. With Scores, we have a game of directions and actions, and we're expected to perform in certain ways that are either potentially inventive or may have other sort of objectives attached to them. With The Lost Garden, you know, we have a video-based game, and we're experiencing a sonic world that needs to be puzzled through with the sort of stakes around energy transition at the heart of the game. And then with The Secret Storm, it's a game that deals with sustainability, of course, and there's role-playing, and we do have, in some sense, a little bit more of an end goal around, you know, having acquired some knowledge and made some decisions that actually should have some real world impact. So hearing all this, did you ever anticipate that speculative energy futures would offer such a kind of panoply of experiential opportunities? Was gaming or games, was that something you anticipated when you were thinking about this project?
Thank you for the question, Patrick. And it's making me kind of look back and reflect in a different way than I have before on speculative energy futures, because I've joked many times that it's quite, you know, I find it quite amusing that we have so many games on speculative energy futures, because I don't like to play games. I really have to have my arm twisted to like join the family Christmas game or, you know, so I don't really love games, but I'm thinking about how it all came about in a way. I mean, clearly people came with expertise and interest. That's obvious. But also I'm thinking back, I don't know if I've mentioned this on the podcast or not, but we had started the project out. And the first thing we did to facilitate this group of diverse people that didn't know each other from across the country was that I, at the time, was an Energy Futures Lab fellow. Now I'm an ambassador for the Energy Futures Lab. And the Energy Futures Lab, several of the facilitators there had been trained to facilitate a game that I believe was called The Great Transition. And when I had played that game with the Energy Futures Lab, I'd been a bit struck because a lot of members of the Energy Futures Lab, particularly at that time, came from the energy sector and from industry. And industry played a very important role. And in fact, I think it was a modified game from some kind of game that Shell had developed to play as a, you know, an energy transition think tank project. And I was like, where are the citizens? Where are the universities? Where is the knowledge production? But still, I thought it was interesting to have our team play it. So we hired members of the Energy Futures Lab to facilitate it for us. But, you know, in some ways, speculative energy futures is about the things that you just summarized, Patrick. It's about changing the rules of the game and experimenting with how you change the rules of the game. I mean, the big rules of the game, like the, you know, the economy and the politics and our social ways of being with each other. And, you know, like Scott's game, it's a change of perspective. It's looking at the world in a different way and engaging in a different way, whether that means, you know, thinking about the cricket or your soundscape. And, you know, we have quite a few sound experts or people interested in these things. I mean, Scott's our big sound person on the project, but we've done a number of things that have got us thinking more about sound. And I love the way Scott's brought into the project the way our sonic world might be so much better if it wasn't powered by fossil fuels, because it would just totally shift the soundscape, things like that. And Sarayan's game has been a really interesting experiment in engaging with communities, because we, you know, we've had guest speakers come from the Institute, the Gaming Institute in the Netherlands through Eva Bogdan. And we've had, you know, we've had connections and interactions with other gaming experts in town here who've worked on that game. We've played it with members like communities linked to the Sustainability Council and to Speculative Energy Futures, and his students and our team have played it. And so it's really been a great way to connect. So as somebody who doesn't play games typically, I might be shifting my perspective. And I think the difference too is that these games, I like with when we played the Great Transition, Natalie joked that we broke the game, right? Because we weren't competing with each other. We were collaborating, and suddenly the facilitators didn't know what to do with us and the game wasn't working anymore because we weren't competing. And so we really were kind of breaking the rules. And these games are really about dialogue and talking and experimenting and collaborating and working together and thinking about where we're doing this work. So, you know, really feminist and decolonial. So so maybe I'm being converted to games, but I mean, the short answer to your question is no, I never, ever would have anticipated this, Patrick. It certainly wasn't written into the grant applications. I didn't see it coming, right? But it's been very fun. Yeah. Oh, and look at people want to jump in and talk now. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, first of all, I also kind of hate games, even though obviously I'm making them now, but I totally relate to what you're saying, Sheena. And well, first of all, games are multifaceted. There are so many genres. I thought music was bad, but games, it just goes in so many directions. And when I look at the three games here, I see clearly that they are three very different kinds of games. I mean, Sarayan's game is really like a strategy game with real people who have to take on fictional roles. They're almost like, it's almost like an RPG, only you're not shooting, but you're it's like Civilization or many of these other games that invite you to think about the larger structures behind the way we live and actually having to take on roles and understanding how to manage resources and all of that. My game is, I didn't actually really describe what you do in the game, I realized, but it's really kind of an escape game. And I would say, in a sense, it's progressive, meaning that you kind of have to get from one place to another to do what you're called upon to eventually do, which is find the lost garden. And then our game with the scores piece, it's funny because I actually think it's kind of an open world game in a way. It's like we've laid out these mechanics. We're not telling anybody what direction they need to go, that they can sort of engage with the cards and the invitations and the descriptions and all that in a variety of ways.
I love the way you just broke that down, Scott. And yeah, you're right. The open world quality of scores is something that, like, every time I've played it, it's been a different game. And it's really, really kind of exciting for that. But what I wanted to say is I was just reflecting when Sheena was talking too, and this is in like also response to your last question to Sarayan, Patrick, in terms of pedagogy. And you were describing how we broke the game, the great transition, and I remember when I was playing Perfect Storm with you, like Sarayan, I played it a few times, but you know, that role playing aspect of, you know, not just thinking about what one might do on the ground, but actually playing the game and suddenly having to, you know, articulate the logics from the perspective of the role that you've been given. And then how that changes how you're going to negotiate with others. What I love about that, and you know, all of the games really, and in fact, I think the whole Flux Kit and the whole Speculative Energy Futures project is the experiential drive that, you know, has at its core an understanding of the importance of shifting from informational to transformational pedagogical modalities. You know, I think like one of our taglines, Sheena, you know, from the beginning has been, you know, we have enough information. Mm. we have enough information. All we have to do is look around us to see that having the information is not shifting action on the ground. Something else is needed.
That's great. So Ryan, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. All of us talking together has really crystallized for me also the fact that I don't like playing games and somehow or other. And I was just thinking as you folks were talking about how it is that when people hear that I've done this game, they kind of automatically assume that I'm a big fan of games, and they start asking me, have you played this game? Have you played that game? And I never have. And it's because I don't really enjoy them very much, kind of thing. I just wanted to sort of follow up on some of the things that both Scott and Natalie were talking about, and particularly in terms of this idea of the open world game kind of thing, because if I think about, you know, what it is that then, given the fact that really deep down I don't enjoy playing games, why I would actually have decided to use the game as a way of doing my research. And, you know, one of the things that really fascinated me, I guess, and the reason why, despite my dislike of games, that I decided to work on a game, is the fact that playing is something that is so ancient in human existence, right? And games are so ancient in human existence that there is something very, very fascinating about games as a medium and as a genre and as a practice and so on. And I think that's what ultimately seduced me into sort of, despite all my dislike, I got to sort of dive in and sort of see where this goes. And in that respect, you know, and this is particularly the case in a kind of pedagogic context and doing an educational game and so on, if I could kind of put it in this way, that all games have to deal with this God problem, if I could put it that way, because all games project some kind of fictional world, but that fictional world is embedded in a historical context, embedded in ongoing politics and social change and so on and so forth. And so you always have this kind of tension between what it is that makes the fictional world cohere together and make sense and be logical and be understandable and truthful in its own, if you think of games all having their own kind of regime of truth in that regard, right? So they all have that fiction of expertise and that fiction of the solution to the problem, the way to win, the strategy that wins. And in the educational context, and particularly the kind of tradition of game and research that I was sort of coming out of most proximately, I guess, is that, you know, there's basically two types of games in that regard. One are those sort of very common in resource management and other kinds of fields like that, where the game is about teaching people in a way the scientific method and how science will solve some kind of problem, dispute, conflict, and so on. And then the second kind has that element in it, but it's more dialogical. So the idea is that the winning of the game or the the solution of the problem that the game is helping people solve a problem. I mean, these are all in the context of games as being a kind of means to solve a problem kind of thing, right? That the solution would be reason. So the best argument wins the game kind of thing, right? And this is where I think that in intermediate research creation, which really leans very heavily on kind of Jacques Rancière's, what he wants to say about contemporary critical art is that the aesthetic experience of art creates this equality of intelligences in that situation. And the game creates this kind of situation. And the whole problem the game has to deal with is how to make that God thing enjoyable in some kind of way.
And you know what you're reminding me of, Sarayan, is also I think it's like when Haraway writes about play, you know, play in canine culture. And I think she's drawing on Geertz, right? Geertz and games and play, right? But the kind of social contract that's being negotiated through playing a game where, you know, I think if I'm remembering correctly, the anecdote that she was writing about it, they're two dogs and they're like growling at each other, but they're playing, right? And I've seen this here in your place, you know, with the, you know, big teddy and small Midge, where like they're growling and pushing. And if you don't know that they're playing, you know, like sometimes it's like that line between play and threat, between game and threat, is only legible to the two of them until like you get to know them. But if somebody just walked in and didn't know these two creatures and just walked in on this, you know, someone might say, "Stop, Teddy, you're going to like eat Midge's head," because basically Midge's head is about the size of his mouth. Right. But you know, this, so I guess you're inviting me to think about the ways in which through games, we kind of organize around the rules and, you know, work them out together in ways that may have much more potential.
I certainly can chime in and say I don't like playing games either, but I've always felt that as an artist, one of the sort of dispositions I think we need to take when we're making a modern artwork is that we're solving the problem as we identify it. So we don't have a rule book that says this is the problem to solve, but we set out with a hunch or we set out with an intention. And as we work that way, we begin to actually clarify the problem that we're already on the way to solving, which I think actually has some analogs with speculative energy futures. But I was thinking about the problem of seriousness and thinking that as artists, you know, we're often not thought of as overly important to the real solutions. And as game players, that we couldn't possibly be doing something serious. And when the problem is as vast and demanding as it is with speculative energy futures, you know, I'm not here to say I get why people aren't thinking that designing games is going to fix things, but I am interested in the question, if we actually have done this great work, are there ways that those ways of thinking can actually map on to, I want to call it, the real world challenge of sustainability, speculative energy, or of energy transition? And, you know, I realize that's a kind of a vast question, but I think, you know, as we start talking about Rancière and aesthetics and what he's saying, there's a sense in which we have models of thought that I think actually really have some heft to them that we can adhere to in order to argue that this is not just play for play's sake. So I don't know if anybody wants to jump in on that, Scott.
I love that comment. I think when I said libraries of agencies, I don't know if he made it up, but that's a phrase that I read in Tai Nguyen's book, Agency as Art. And one of the things I really appreciated about that book is the way he sort of defines something called striving games, I think is the term he uses, which is essentially games that there may or may not be a win state, but there usually is a win state. But the thing that draws you into playing the game is really not winning. Even though, I mean, we all assume that if you play a game, you want to win it, and the end goal is really important. And one of the examples he gives that I love is rock climbing. I am not a rock climber, but I get rock climbing. And the funny story he tells is about like climbing up a really difficult rock face and getting almost to the top and looking up and seeing a four-year-old who says, well, you know, if you go around the other side, like you can just walk right up. It's like really easy. And it's like So there you go. Playing the game of rock climbing is not really about getting to the top, right? It's about putting your body in these beautiful, weird positions and challenging it to, it's kind of about loving the way bodies move and the beauty of that. It's almost like dancing. It's kind of how he was describing it. And I really appreciated that because it made me realize that so often when I've played games, like I, you know, maybe I'll use your game, Sryan, as an example. I also played an early version of your game. And I'm trying to answer your question, Patrick, by saying that the thing that I learned about your game was I quickly realized that I didn't care about winning and I didn't think I would anyway. But what I opened my eyes was that the role that I was taking on required me to understand the world through a very specific lens.
I had a couple of ideas about what Scott said too. One of them is that, you know, when you start playing these role-playing games, it made me realize how much like life is and you start actually being that role. And then at some point in the game, I thought to myself, wait a second, these aren't my politics just because I was assigned this role. What am I doing? I could do this differently, you know, just like we could do the role we're playing in life differently. So I think, you know, but you do that in a 2-hour, you know, game. It doesn't take you a half a lifetime to realize you need to change the way you're performing your role. So that was one big takeaway for me. And I think also, you know, each of these things was transformative. And we were talking on the last podcast with, you know, Lisa and Sean about how storytelling can be transformative, but there are ways to step into scenarios and step into situations and to do this in a joyful way that includes fun and, you know, maybe sadness and affect, depending on what the story is or the game is. But all of these things help us have these mini experiences that are much more transformative than just reading about it in the news and reading about doomsday. So if we have to imagine a better world or a different world, well, there's a lot better chance that we're going to do it from inside one of these creative strategies, whether that's storytelling or game playing or any of the other things we've done on speculative energy futures, than always being theoretical, always being only in our heads, never being embodied, right? Never relating emotionally or getting overly excited or shouting during the game or, you know, like some of these games get pretty lively, right? So I think that element of joy and fun has been a real gift of the gaming.
The way you just described that, I was like, oh, right. I was made present up to like risk and to kind of amateur status and all of the things that we give ourselves the permission to do when we're playing that in fact are really, really crucial to kind of actually carving new pathways, making new discoveries, you know, creating new ways of, you know, doing and being together that are outside of what we already know. If we don't take those risks, if we don't play, you know, give ourselves the grace and the generosity to play, then all we're left with is reproducing the same.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. So I do really appreciate your call for embodiment, Sheena, because I think there's a way in which a lot of the games we are talking about that we don't like are not overly embodied. They're about abiding by a kind of a system and hopefully winning within that system, but not changing the system. So Ryan, anything you want to jump in on?
Yeah, to sort of follow up on a number of things that all of you have said in terms of the question of seriousness or, you know, what can games really kind of do. And it's kind of funny in a way that in the context of research and gamification and research, and particularly in the social sciences, and I think this is a peculiarly European term as well, they talk about these kinds of games as being serious games. And I always thought, oh, that's such a terrible term, you know, the serious games. But the thing about it really is this relationship, I guess, between what a game can do, pleasure, and or enjoyment, you know, those things, and the aspect of competition. And one of the things that I kind of brought to this this particular project. There was a Canadian communication theorist by the name of Anthony Wilden, who I had the great fortune to have as a kind of mentor earlier in my life. And one of the things that he wrote about, and he came up with this kind of grammar, I suppose, in a way, about games and sports and many other aspects of human life. He said that where there is competition in terms of how it is that people interact with one another, but those forms of competition are kind of messages where there's a deeper level code or a system of norms or rules and so on and so forth that are cooperative. So the example that Scott was talking about in terms of rock climbing, which also holds for soccer, hockey, everything else, all kinds of sports and games and so on and so forth, is that the whole point of the competition is not just to win or not to win, but is to play the game, right? In that regard, and the pleasure of playing the game, having other people watch the game, all of those kinds of things. And Wilden's point is that in capitalism, what you have is a very uniquely different form of competition, where it's competition that is the deeper structural code under which all other kinds of cooperation takes place. Because ultimately, people have to compete with one another in the labor market in order to get a job and, you know, meet their livelihood means and so on. And even businesses have to compete with one another in order to get credit to do what it is that they do. But none of those things, whether it's the reproduction of a household or the running of a business, is possible without cooperation. And so human cooperation, I mean, this is where we see how competition, and it's a very competition without it being constrained by rules of cooperation, is basically war, right? And this is the, you know, one way of understanding the difference between a world that's always at war and a world that has the possibility of peace. I mean, this is what Tony Wilden was trying to argue in his work. And I think that in terms of the seriousness of the game in that regard, I mean, one of the things that really convinced me that there was something to this is when I was doing this in the classroom, one of the students that I had in the class, or there was a group of them that were very, very involved and engaged in environmental justice activism and climate activism and so on. They were very, very passionate about these issues and spent a lot of time and energy outside of their studies being involved in all of this kind of stuff. And at that time, I sort of had arranged it in such a way that the students could get a first crack at choosing what a role that they would play. I mean, this is always in a teaching context a complicated thing, because either people have to choose in time or else everything gets messed up and so on. But anyway, I let them choose. And these students all chose the oil company. You know, they wanted to play the oil industry, right? And we were just chatting and they were saying, yeah, we really wanted to do this because we really wanted to understand that point of view in the world and how that works and what you'd have to do. And I mean, they talked about this in the kind of at the end of the course, where there's kind of reflecting on the game element and the game requirement and all that kind of stuff. This is what they were writing about, is, you know, that this was what was very valuable to them because it really helped them understand something that they felt was really important to understand, that was a big part of their passion, but they didn't know how to deal with it in any kind of way. And I thought, yes, you know, this is what this kind of stepping into a fictional role can be, really transformative and pedagogic at the same time in that kind of way.
This was a really great conversation, though. Thank you for leading it, Patrick. And thanks to the three of you as well, because I really had new thoughts while we were talking. So it's been really a fantastic hour to spend together.
It's great to meet all these people who think they didn't like games and now they do. I think you and I have talked before, Sheena, about there being aspects of this project that actually I think sort of mimic or kind of parallel oftentimes the way sometimes artists solve problems. And that is, they identify the problem more fully as they work towards a solution. So we don't sit down and say, okay, what's the problem? And now we're going to come up with a solution. But we often begin with a hunch. And so even with these games, we might have been beginning with a hunch as to where this game is leading and what might be considered a win. But I think the further we got into these games, we had a greater sense of dealing with complexity and dealing with complexity in ways that require some fairly original and innovative thinking that we might not have known we have access to, but for attempting to work with these games.
That also reminds me of something that I was thinking about earlier, Patrick, and that is that as somebody who came to this project, who used and still uses, say, storytelling or creative nonfiction writing or, you know, fiction writing or podcasting or filmmaking as research creation tools, but I'm not an artist and I wasn't an artist when I came into this project and I had never worked so intensively with so many artists before, is that I would have never thought of games as art. It was fun for me to see how many games were produced on this project and to imagine the possibilities that will come from people activating those games, you know, taking up the Flux Kit, playing those games in classroom spaces, community halls, maybe around policy tables. That is the idea for these games, is to activate them with your spheres of influence. And everyone has different spheres of influence, and that these games might do work in the world that we hope for, but that we can't also anticipate or speculate about. You know, some of these games are downloadable off the Just Powers website, justpowers.ca. There's a Speculative Energy Futures and Flux Kit, a Speculative Energy Futures Flux Kit website, where people can have access if they don't even write to ask for the whole box to be delivered to them, the whole Flux Kit to be delivered. You can download a lot of these items and play these games in various spaces. So I hope people will do that. This is an invitation to everyone to become part of the Flux Kit for Energy Transition, to activate it, and to let us know how it works out for you and your communities. So thanks for joining us today. And thanks, Patrick, for guest hosting once again, a really, really interesting conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sheena. And I absolutely agree. I think the conversation we heard today and were part of has been really stimulating. And I think that it also opens itself up to some of the other things that are coming up. We're going to be talking about plants and how they matter. And we're also going to be talking about satire in upcoming podcasts. So, you know, I think all of the kinds of things that we're doing in this series really are invitations to people to really sort of engage in ways that they might not have imagined were possible when it comes to thinking about a challenge like energy transition. So thank you.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to the sixth series of the Just Powers podcast, Reflector, on the topic of speculative energy futures, which uses research creation as an
remind us who, and
energy transition. Be sure to visit the Just Powers website at justpowers.ca, where you can learn more about speculative energy futures and explore the Flux Kit. You will also find information about our ongoing projects and access to more resources. This podcast is made possible by support from Future Energy Systems Canada, the First Research Excellence Fund, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, the Cool Institute of Advanced Study, the University of Alberta, Alberta Eco Trust, and the City of Edmonton. Special thanks to our guest host, Patrick Mann. This series was co-produced by myself, Sheena Wilson, Patrick Mann, Katie Lewandowski, and Sarah Taylor. Post-production was provided by Story Darling Studios in Edmonton, Alberta. This episode was edited by Sarah Taylor, CCE, and Blair Drover, mixed and mastered by Tony Bao, and music from Artlist.